Welcome to Foul Players Radio, your podcast for arts, entertainment, and pop culture. My name is Michael Spedden, your host. Every episode features interesting people with fun, fascinating stories about their journeys in the performing arts. Authors, actors, dancers, writers, musicians, athletes, comics, you name it. Folks who are center stage, backstage, on camera, or behind the scenes. Sit back and listen. Let's have some fun. Foul Players Radio is a production of the Foul Players Group and a proud member of the SJ Network. And welcome again to the Rising from the Ashes edition of Foul Players Radio. My name is Michael Spedden. Tonight's guest is A.D. Adams. We welcome A.D. Adams to Foul Players Radio. He's a veteran drummer, originally from Michigan, but he began his career in the D.C. Northern Virginia area, performing with such bands as Monarch and Centerfold. He eventually became the house production manager at the Bayou in Washington, D.C. for several years, and then he got back into drumming. He's toured and recorded with many well-known artists, has appeared on 24 full-length albums and scores of singles, and has great stories, which made for a very entertaining interview, I must say, such as hearing how Graham Chapman claimed that he and Keith Moon invented bungee jumping, getting the business from Lemmy of Motorhead and giving it right back to him, A Wild Night with Matt Sorum from Guns N' Roses, doing sound at the Bayou for Todd Rundgren, Iggy Pop, The Ramones, Charlie Watts, and many others, filling in on drums during a sound check with the band, and so much more. We also discussed the lost art of flyering and meeting people face-to-face to promote shows, and what a big part of a magical time that was. Plus, we get to hear about how A.D. got yelled at by Chuck Berry. I thank A.D. for appearing on Foul Players Radio and sharing many of his experiences, and he has many more, according to him, and we're going to have him back for a future episode. According to A.D., we just scratched the surface. You can hear past episodes of A.D.'s former podcast, Shabby Road Records Show, on Apple Podcasts and many other platforms. He can also be seen on The Recording Artist on Amazon Prime. Subscribe for free at www.foulplayersradio.com or listen on Apple Podcasts, Google Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, iHeartRadio, Podcast Addict, Podchaser, Pocket Cast, Deezer, Listen Notes, Player FM, Podcast Index, Overcast, Castro, Castbox, or Podfriend. You can also follow us on Facebook, Instagram, and Twitter. The Foul Players of Perryville are now booking murder mystery shows for the late summer and fall of 2021. Indoor or outdoor venues, trains, boats, office parties, fundraisers, or just for the heck of it. www.foulplayersofperryville.com or you can reach us at foulplayersperryville@yahoo.com or 443-600-0446. We'll be back with A.D. Adams right after these words.
Hey, what's up, guys? It's Christopher Stolle of Breaking the Fourth Wall. If you enjoy our show, you can find it on YouTube. Just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment, or just look up Realm of the Mist Entertainment on Anchor.fm, Apple iTunes, Spotify, Pandora, iHeartRadio, or wherever quality podcasts can be heard. And also, you can find us on all the social medias. Just look for Realm of the Mist Entertainment, and I will catch you on the other side.
I'm Michael, the host of the semi-monthly podcast, In a City Like Yours. Join me as I chat with interesting people with interesting life stories. You can listen to the podcast on all major podcast platforms, including Apple, Spotify, Stitcher, and TuneIn. You can follow us on Twitter at IACLYS Podcast, as well as on Facebook and Instagram at In a City Like Yours Podcast. Please feel free to let me know what you think, and keep coming back for the many interesting stories in a city like yours.
Hey, this is Don Smith from the Life Radio Show. If you've always wanted to learn more about the world of low-budget filmmaking and even lower-budget comedy, tune into the Life Radio Show. You can live stream the show at WWSU1069.org on Tuesdays from 7 to 9 p.m. Eastern, or find us wherever you find podcasts and like and follow the Life Radio Show on Facebook for live video and other shenanigans.
Hey, what's up? This is Christopher Stolle of Realm of the Mist Entertainment. The podcast you are listening to is part of the SJ Network. Go to s-j-network.com. That's s-j-network.com for more great podcasts and information on those shows, as well as information and ability to contact publicist Steve Joyner for more information. Just go to the website and check out the family. Ladies and gentlemen, until then, enjoy the show.
Well, AD Adams, welcome to Foul Players Radio. It's a pleasure to have you. We've been talking a lot about your career, and you've done a lot of great things on here I'd love to hear about. And are you originally from the D.C. area?
Well, no. First of all, thanks for having me, Michael. Appreciate it, man.
Oh, I'm glad to have you.
Podcast is a lot of fun, man. I like where you're going with the whole thing, keeping it local, you know, all that. So it's a lot of fun, man. I'm looking forward to diving into some back episodes too, so that'd be fun. But no, man, I grew up in DC. I was born sort of in the shadows of Motown up in Michigan.
My dad
went to the I was born in a little burg outside, you know, of the Glove, but my dad went to University of Michigan for broadcasting, so that put us in that area when I was 2 years old, and we moved to DC right around then. He got a gig doing broadcasting with NBC WRC TV.
Oh, is that right?
Channel 4 in DC. Yeah, so he got a gig doing that right out of college, and he was, you know, sweeping the floors, repairing cables, and worked his way up and stuff. So that was my that was our upbringing, just kind of in the with the media in a weird way. But the spark came obviously in February of 1964. You know, a typical story. Saw the Beatles, you know, had to play. I've got an older brother, Jeff. Mm-hmm. Ironically enough, his name is Jeff Adams, lead guitar player, who is not the Jeff Adams who played with Face Dancer. Just to get that straight, because there's a Jeff Adams and Face Dancer, and you know, great DC Baltimore band, one of the best as far as I'm concerned ever out of that area.
Oh yeah, I've had Scott McGinn on as a guest, and he was absolutely great with the stories he told. And
Scott's a brilliant, great guy. He and I have become very good friends in the last couple of years.
Oh good.
I toured last year. I toured through DC. Well, year before, last year was kind of a bust, but year before we toured through DC at the City Winery, did a show there. And Scott and his wife came out, and he and I had been friends for about a couple of years after before that. I kind of hit him up and said, hey, just one of those things where, you know, thank you. Cause Face Dancer, well, I'm getting ahead of myself, but my brother and I, he played guitar, I played drums. We grew up in the same bedroom. We learned how to play to all the records, including Crack the Sky, another great DC, Baltimore, West Virginia area band.
Oh, absolutely.
And then we formed, it was the only band I'd ever been in. It was a little band. We ended up calling it Monarch. And we did okay. You know, we did all right in the area. We were touring from Maine to Florida, doing all the big joints, Hammer Jacks, the Bayou. We were doing, you know, the back of the rack down at Ocean City. Mm-hmm. But going as far north as Maine, going as far south as Florida, and as far west as pretty much the Mississippi. We kind of kept it east, and we made a pretty good run of that. We did some good things. We did some bad things.
Didn't we all, you know?
Oh, well, you know, the times were different back then, and there weren't cameras everywhere, which is a really good thing. But yeah, so I think we did really well. We were constantly flirting with the major labels, Warner Brothers in particular, befriended Ronnie Dio. He was helpful to us to a degree, you know, and then it just played itself out. It was the middle of the 80s. The only band I'd ever been in. I'm in it with my brother. Sometimes it was, you know, there's a lot of love, but it was friction. The famous stories about brothers in the band. Mm-hmm. We could talk about Ray and Dave Davies or the Robinson brothers for the Black Crows, or the brothers from the for Oasis.
Oh,
the list
Lord.
Goes on.
Woo,
now,
Lord.
I love my brother and he loves me. We get along great. But there were times when it was like, all right, this is, you know, we're going to kill each other. So it ran its course. I split in late 85, early 86, and immediately jumped in with a band called Dirty Looks.
Oh, sure.
Yeah. Did an album with them. And before they got signed with Atlantic, that just didn't work out. To me, it was just like I wasn't happy in that situation. They were rehearsing up in Selins Grove, Pennsylvania, up north of Harrisonburg.
Yep.
And I was living in D.C.
Oh.
And so, I'd commute. I'd go up for the week and then come home on the weekends. And it just was like, and it, honestly, with the drumming, great band. You know, they had their success. Gene Barnett ended up taking my place. But to me, it just was just pedestrian drumming. And I wanted to do something that I could, you know, instead, you know, the four on the floor, boosh, bash, boosh, bash. And that was it. And it was, to me, I wanted more out of what I was playing. After that, I just stopped for a little bit. Well, we'll call them substance issues because that's what they are. I hope you don't mind me being too frank here because sometimes I am a little too honest. I quit playing for a little bit and started pursuing audio. So I had played the Bayou a million times and was thinking, God, you know, I want to do something else. And it was, you know, building home studios and stuff like that with some guys I was working with. And Iggy Pop ended up playing at the Bayou and I wanted to go. So, I never paid for a show at the Bayou. I just call my buds and go, hey, put me on a guest list. And, you know, so he said, well, the fire marshal's going to be here and we're sold out. I would love to, but I can't. I'm like, crap. About an hour later, I get a phone call saying, well, the monitor guy just called in sick. Do you know how to run monitors? Well, yes, I do, which I never did in my life. But I wanted to see Iggy. So I went in and got about a 5-minute tutorial on how to run a Yamaha monitor mix, 10 mixes. And that was the beginning of my audio career. I guess I did pretty good. So I ended up working at the Bayou doing first the assistant manager for the sound guy there. And then he split. And then I ended up as the house production manager. So I'm doing Charlie Watts of the Rolling Stones, the Ramones, Todd Rundgren. I mean, you name it, Sam Kinison. Anyone from there. I did two nights with Graham Chapman from the Monty Python troupe. Yeah.
Oh, man.
It was insane, right? I mean, it was like two nights with that guy. And he was telling me the greatest stories. He and Keith Moon were great friends. Mm-hmm. And he's telling me, like, you know, they invented bungee jumping, him and Keith Moon. but he goes, well, mate, we did it wrong. What we did was they took a flagpole and tied the bungee to the top of the flagpole with like a swing set saddle at the bottom. And they, as they pulled it back and they let it go, and he goes, well, they kept hitting the pole. So they had to rethink it, you know, and of course the rest is history, but yeah, he was great. So, I mean, you know, Charlie with the Rolling Stones, Molly Hatcher, I mean, you name it, they came through. I mean, the Bayou, everybody who's ever lived in DC in that era knows the Bayou.
What a great room.
Oh my God. You know, I mean, Monarch, we played it every Thanksgiving Eve, the Wednesday night before Thanksgiving for years and years and years. And that was kind of our night there every year. That was automatic. That was booked. That was, you know, our thing. So I had a great run as a musician at the Bayou. But even after that, I had a great little mini career running sound at the Bayou. And I learned as I went. You know, I'd been in enough recording studios by then and had enough experience with live engineers and stuff like that, and monitors and stuff. So I figured with the knowledge that I'd sort of acquired through just being basically an infomaniac. I want to know about the lighting. I want to know about, you know, the colors that you're using. I want to know the octane of the gas that the bus is using. I mean, I'm one of those guys. I just want to, you know, absorb it all. And so I was able to step into that pretty seamlessly and then learn along the way. And then through that, I got a gig touring with a soul band, R&B band called Starpoint. And we did shows. I mean, and then it was Patti LaBelle, Cameo, Mary Jane. I mean, there was a ton of things. So that was a great experience for me. And then that ended. That was about 8 months on the road with that. I came back and wasn't 100% ready to play yet, but I ran into some great, great old friends of mine who had been, you know, calling me for a while after I split Monarch and Dirty Looks. Hey, we should get together and write and record and see what happens. And I kept putting it off for no reason in particular, just that the sound thing was working for me. And I think it was a little burned out on the playing. It was a guy named Mark Schenker who is currently the he's currently the bass player for Kix. He and a guy named Rob Galpin had played in a band called Gastum that had opened for Monarch a bunch of times. And they were great, great players, younger, a bit younger than myself, but really talented, great writers, both of them, and just great guys. So I ended up hooking up with them. We formed a little band called Centerfold, which immediately took off. We did Hammer Jacks. We did the Bayou. We did all the, you know, all the big venues around town immediately upon forming. We didn't have to go through the ranks. The songs were very strong. Rob Galpin, an incredible writer. He even wrote some stuff for Funny Money, which was Steve Whiteman's and Mark Schenker's interim band when Kix went on hiatus or sort of broke up slash didn't break up for a while and then reformed. Funny Money was the band, and Mark was in that band and Robbie was writing for him. So, you know, they're strong, strong players. So it turned out to be a really cool thing. They ended up making me the singer, the lead singer. We signed with CMC International Records. Mm-hmm. I did most of the singing from the back of the kit, which is also what I did with Monarch, which was kind of a unique thing. Mm-hmm. The record label kept insisting that I sing lead. And I was totally against it. I'm like, I'm the drummer. I'll sing harmonies. Let's get a lead singer. Well, it didn't work out. So they put me up front and we got a great local drummer from Virginia. I think he's from Dumfries or that area, Lorton Dumfries area. A guy named Joe Hasselvander. And Joe used to play with a band called The Boys long time ago. B-O-Y-Z for you DC freaks. You know who I'm talking about. And great band, great dudes. I love those guys. He also played with Pentagram, the heavy metal band Pentagram. So Joe was our drummer. We did our thing. It just, the record label was making some weird demands of us. And again, it was like, we're done. I'm not interested. I don't like, you know, with me, I've had a long career of avoiding the boss, so to speak. You know, I've always been doing it like independent. It's like the label says, you got to do this. We said, well, we don't gotta, we might, but we don't gotta. And so I always shy away from that. I still do and always have. So, which maybe has kept my career alive. I don't owe anybody $1 million.
Yeah, I see what you mean about that, because I've had a lot of folks on my on the show that have been like television producers, for example. And a lot of times just some decisions that are made that they have to deal with, the jumps and the hoops they have to jump through that are made by non-creative people, people that aren't
exactly
writers, or they really don't understand how to put together a TV show, but they make these decisions that you end up getting stuck with. And I definitely know the frustration with that. And I can kind of see where you're coming from with that, you know, not wanting, you know, avoiding the boss, like you were saying.
Yeah. You know, I mean, I don't, you know, I got into this whole thing because I saw my dad, God bless him. He was a great, he was a great dad, still is. But I saw him every morning put that suit and tie on. And he was not in a hurry to get to work. You know what I mean? I mean, and at the end of the day, you know, mom would be like, dad's coming home. You kids might want to keep it down a little bit. And he'd come in and that tie was loose and the collar was open. And he'd head straight for the Bromo seltzer, you know? And I'm like, I'm not going to be doing that. And so I got into this to not have that boss. Now, I know that you got to have record label, you know, input or distribution. I know that there you're not an island. It does take a team.
Right.
But with the Warner Brothers, you know, they were talking about big money. And I think a lot of people forget is that, you know, hey, the label, you know, we got a $500,000 record deal. And, you know, hey, guess what? You just signed a half a million dollar loan is what you did.
Yeah. Yeah.
That's what that, technically, you know, and if you don't feel that the label is going to do what you want them to do, you know, they're going to lend you money, but they're going to call the shots. And I'm like, nah, it's not my bag. I'm not into that. You know, if you're going to lend me the money to do what I'm doing it my way. It's just kind of the way I've always been. So, and again, I think that, you know, I've met a lot of very famous rock and roll musicians or other blues, you know, jazz musicians along the way. And the ones, a good portion of them who got that big deal a long time ago, they're broke. They're still paying back some of those loans. And so I've always kind of sidestep that. I'll get on their front porch just enough to know that I'm doing something right. And then I'll go, thanks for the advice. I'm out of here. Mm-hmm. And I've been able to do that. I'm 61 years old now. And, I'm still making records, so.
Sure.
That's kind of a cool thing. You know, I haven't cashed that $1 million check yet. But at the same time, I don't know anybody that $1 million check either. So I think I'm balancing a pretty good act right now,
That sounds like it. That sounds like there are so many things that you don't always think of when it comes to getting signed. A lot of times these young folks, they're offered a record label or offered a contract. In other words, they're seeing dollar signs and then they don't realize really how it is.
Right.
In real life until, after a while, I've heard some stories about some people saying, every six pack they ordered on the road, they got a bill for that came out of that money.
Those limousines that are so cool at the airport with the guy with the little sign with your name on it, the cool little limo guy hat.
Yep.
Yeah, you're paying for that. For that. Yeah. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
Everything. I figured that out.
Oh, yeah. Yeah. All of those things add up over time. And then sometimes I've heard of people they're not allowed to play their own material or they don't have rights to it, or they can't use the band name anymore.
Right.
I saw somebody that I really liked, and I'm not going to mention their name because I know there was legal trouble, but I went to see them after they had left the band they were in play at the Network. Or whatever the network was after the network.
It was Sandbar Network,
or something, one of those. And really disappointed the crowd because he could not play all of the songs from the previous band that he was in that was well known. He was only allowed to get up and do like maybe a chorus or two on acoustic guitar. He did like a medley. And then just really had to stick with his own material that had been out and that just wasn't known the crowd was kind of didn't take too well to that. Yeah. And I can see where he was in a situation where I guess you got to keep going and make money to feed yourself and stuff. But
we've all seen it far too often. We've seen it far too often. So, I started thinking about ways to when we got too close and all of a sudden the label's starting to make a lot of demands. I'm like, this isn't good. Rob was the first one to bail. We drove home from a session one day. We were doing pre-production for what would have been our record. Mm-hmm. And we were joking. He goes, I said something and he just goes, yeah, I'm done. Mm-hmm. I go, what? He goes, yeah, I'm done. And we're all laughing. I'm done too. Yeah, I'm done too. From the back of the van. And we're looking at him and he wasn't kidding.
Right.
And I'm like, good. That's the smart decision ultimately. Cause we'd owed them. We'd owed them big time. And they didn't seem like they were interested. They signed us and then they immediately went to change us. Why do you want us? You get somebody else to do that. Find the band that does that.
Mm-hmm.
So it's just really put me off. So, at that point in time, I was just really, again, the substances now were really catching up to me. Mm-hmm. I went through a really bad breakup, sort of the girl that got away. And, it was, woe is me, So I quit for a while. I worked Venomin Music. Do you remember Venomin's?
Absolutely. What a great store.
Oh, the best. I got all my stuff there. I worked at the Springfield location. I was living in Virginia at the time.
Okay, yeah.
It worked there until my second overdose. And then I basically threw a dart at a map. Mm-hmm. Like, if I don't leave D.C., I'm going to die here. And I was just not interested in that. So I literally went to a friend's house, threw a dart at an atlas that we hung on the wall, and it landed near Tucson. I went, Phoenix sounds good.
Mm-hmm.
So I had been through Phoenix and I took off there. So that was 92. So the years at the Bayou and all those other, years in D.C. kind of ended at 92. But my God, the action that was packed into those years, primarily between about 76 and 92, when Monarch first started taking off, was pretty incredible. A lot of stuff was going down there. Louis Rock City. I don't remember Louis Rock City. Bailey's Crossroads, Virginia was. Mm-hmm. A fantastic club. And I remember it was 1979 and I walked into Venomin's and my drum guy was there, Doug McCooch. He's the greatest. Still remember him. Good guy. And he goes, "Hey, man, you guys should get into this battle of the bands." And I'm like, "Ah, I'm not into that kind of thing." And he's like, "It's a, I forget, like $10,000 first prize or something. I forget what the first prize was, but it was pretty good money." And I'm like, "Oh, all right." And so it cost, I forget, it cost some money to enter. Mm-hmm. And so I took the little form home, and none of the guys in the band, I think it was $40 or $20 or something. Nobody wanted to pay. I'm like, "I'll pay for it." So I entered us against the band's wishes. And I mean, bands like local, great local bands like Happy the Man. Do you remember them?
I think they were there. Yeah, that sounds familiar.
Kind of pop, techno-y, very ahead of their time in 79. They were already using a great deal of synthesizers and sampling. And they were really, really hip band, you know, sort of techno-pop. And a bunch of other bands, I think Head East was in it or something. I forget. I may be wrong. Mm-hmm. But by God, we ended up winning that thing. Mm-hmm. And that's what, you know, Monarch went from so playing the B clubs to boom, we started playing the A clubs exclusively. And that's when the touring started. We caught the eye of a guy, a concert promoter up in Maine, who did all, like, he would do Nassau Coliseum, Madison Square Garden. He was sort of like the big concert promoter, doing all the top bands, you know, Kiss and Alice Cooper and Heart and Led Zeppelin at the time, and all the great bands. So he came down and he ended up signing us to a management company or a management contract, which was, well, I don't know. I mean, I could tell you a bunch of stories, but here's how it ends. if you've ever seen the television show American Justice, they have a subseries called The Fugitives. Our old manager is on one of those episodes and currently doing life in jail in Miami. So,
oh, wow.
That's kind of how that turned out. I'm going to leave it at that.
Wow. But,
yeah. So we were teenagers. We're kids. We're babies. I mean, you know, we went through an awful lot. By the time I turned 20 years old, I was in my first gunfight down in Ocean City at a club we were playing, you know, that kind of thing. I mean, it just was, once we got involved in the scene locally, it just spiraled and accelerated, you know, and we got lucky, you know, that Battle of the Bands really propelled us into the A clubs, and people seemed to like what we were doing, you know, so.
That's cool. That's cool. I always liked playing DC. I'm from Baltimore, and I started off playing the clubs up here. But I mean, you know, we're pretty much in a lot of ways, you know, Central Maryland, you know, that kind of scene, Northern Virginia. Some of the ones that I like to play that I had played at. Did you ever do 930?
You know what? Never did 930 ever. They were more of a punk, more, and we were more throwback to hard rock and roll. You know?
Okay. The band I was in, Orange Seed Parade, I was in a hair band called Fritz's Dynamite for a couple of years. And then we kind of ended up forming Orange Seed Parade as a spinoff from that. And we were a little more alternative, kind of heavier alternative, kind of heavy, a heavy Cure meets the Cult meets Bowie, Bauhaus, that kind of thing.
Oh, man, I don't like that. Yeah.
We got a last minute job at the 930 club. I think somebody canceled. They needed us. And I tell you, you want to talk about a club that appreciated their bands. We did all original material and we actually got paid, and it was
right.
Three figures, you know, instead of just, and then they had a nice dressing room for us. They had, you know, food laid out for us and everything. And I thought we had died and gone to heaven.
They really did it right there. They really did it right. And it bums me out I never got to play there. It's weird. There's an odd connection between Monarch. There's a little bug in here that's flying around, driving me nuts. There's a little connection between Monarch and the 930 Club, although we never played there. One of our road crew, his sister Caroline, married Seth Horowitz.
Okay, sure.
So if you know Caroline, his wife, that's Bob Levy's sister.
Is that right?
Was one of our road techs. Yeah, pretty interesting.
I never got to know the person's name there, but I just knew they were great.
Yeah.
And I wanted to play there again, but that never came to be. Another place that we played down there. See, the one thing that I always thought of between the Baltimore and the DC clubs and the scene. DC, I think Baltimore, they had great bands. The bands sounded good. They looked good. They were tight, good musicianship. But Baltimore never had its own sound like LA or New York or Seattle or anything like that. DC kind of did to a certain extent. Did you think
that? Yeah, I think I would tend to agree with you. DC was a slick. It was a little slicker.
Yeah.
If you have two brothers, mm-hmm. and one is the guy who wears the nice clothes and they're neatly pressed,
mm-hmm.
and then you got the beer swilling, you know, bull in a china shop brother. And I say that with love in my heart because I'd be hanging out with the second brother. Right, I love Baltimore. Right. And now I think to add to what you said, so I would totally agree with that.
Mm-hmm.
But I think where it could have been is had Kix mm-hmm. gone to the heights they deserve to have gone. Their record label, shame on you, Atlantic Records. Shame mm-hmm. on you. That band is still the, you know, if you mm-hmm. talk, for lack of better terms, hair bands, 80s mm-hmm. bands, pick your phraseology. But Kix was and still is hands down the best of the best. And I'm not saying that because mm-hmm. there are our local boys at all. They simply were. There was energy and they mm-hmm. created a thing. You know, a lot of people kind of want to tie them. Oh, they seem like or sound like AC/DC. Mm-hmm. And I would have to completely disagree.
No.
You know, I think they had everything they needed to start. And if they if Atlantic Records would have taken care of those boys the way mm-hmm. they should have, Baltimore would have been there. God knows who would have come out of there. I mean, remember Brian Jack?
Oh, certainly.
His band, Child's Play.
They were
those guys would have gotten the attention they deserve, but they didn't get the attention they deserve because mm-hmm. Baltimore was overlooked. And mm-hmm. the big opportunity to focus on Baltimore came with Kix. And I think that mm-hmm. Atlantic really kind of peed in their Wheaties on that one.
And Mystic Force was another one, I think.
Yes, I remember that. Yep, absolutely.
They were awesome. And, you know, another club I wanted to mention, and I didn't know if you'd ever played this. I guess it might not have been this type of club that you would have played. Did you ever remember the 15-minute club at 15th and K?
No, it sounds like a porno I did. No, I was putting myself through college, man.
Well, speaking of which, this was a place, it was sort of an alternative club. And the light show was a giant white wall behind us, and they had projectors, and they were playing the movie The Fantastic Planet.
That was the light show. How cool.
So we were playing that, and I left something in my van. So I walked out front to get something out of my van. It was just like starting to get dark, and we had gotten there a little earlier to set up and everything. And so I forgot what I had to get out of my van. So I walked out to get it, and about every 10 feet on the sidewalk on both sides of the street was a hooker. And these were hookers that were in the whole typical fishnet stocking, mini skirt, giant high heels, hair done up, makeup.
That a girl.
And I'd say, you know, to every maybe 5 or 10 girls out there, there was a pimp. And the pimps looked like something out of the 70s movies with the big hat with the feather and the fur coat. And I thought I'd walked on. I was looking for cameras. I thought I'd walked onto a movie set, but that was real. It was the real deal.
Yeah. Well, we played. Monarch played somewhere, and it wasn't that place, but it was Southeast DC. So you know what I'm talking about.
Yeah, it was
not pretty.
No.
I cannot remember the name of the club. I wish I could, mm-hmm. but we played there twice. They actually loved us, and it was basically in the ghetto.
Mm-hmm.
And we're the only white cats in there. And we're playing rock and roll. And this is a notorious, you know, you're going to get shot bar. Mm. So we played our rock and roll. And somehow they liked us. They just liked us there. And we're like, whoa. So, you know, it comes time to take our first break. And, of course, I'm heading out the back door to roll a fatty, mm-hmm. you know, and smoke up a little bit. And the club owner goes, whoa. Don't go outside, you guys. Mm-hmm. I was like, what's the name of that joint? But yeah, so he kept us inside, wouldn't let us go outside for the break. As you know, mm-hmm. you guys probably want to wait inside here.
Sure.
So he took care of us, and we finished the night. He paid us, like he said.
Mm-hmm.
And when he asked us back at the end of the night, we're like, "Are you?" He's like, "Really?" He goes, mm-hmm. "I love you guys." So we ended up playing back there again. It was a total mismatch. It shouldn't mm-hmm. have. It would have been like Root Boy Slim playing the Apollo.
Yeah. Right.
Yeah. Right. You know. So it was just, it couldn't have been a bigger mismatch. And they loved us. We played there twice. Mm-hmm. And I don't know what happened. They never asked us back, or they went out of business, or somebody got shot. I don't know.
Yeah, I know. Yeah. I've played in some, I remember some places kind of like that where it's just, you know, good Lord, don't step outside. And how the hell do we get booked there? Did you ever do the Paragon?
Oh God. Yeah. Yeah. A bunch of times.
Remember those steps? I tell you, lugging an Ampeg cabinet and an SVT head up those steps. I tell you, if that doesn't put hair on your chest, I don't know what would, you know,
they were narrow. And in the winter time. Oh yeah. My God. Well, remember and across the alley where those steps were, they had for a while the back room there. Remember, they called it the back room, and it was a larger concert venue. It only was open for a small amount of time. I remember we played there a couple of gigs with Face Dancer. We opened for Iron Butterfly there, which is kind of cool.
Right. Yeah.
Yeah. Hey. Kind of cool. But the Paragon, yeah. What was it called? I think it was called the back room at the Paragon or something like that.
I only ever played upstairs, but
yeah. And the whole place was done up like the Lord of the Rings. Remember the whole perimeter of the club, every wall in the place was a sort of artistic chronology, if you will. Work with me on that one, of Lord of the Rings. Pretty cool. Right.
Did you ever do the Rage?
Yes, we did the Rage. Yeah.
Oh, that was our home base. That was our home base back in those days, especially in Orange Seed Parade. As a matter of fact, we got booked at the Paragon and at the Rage in the same night. There was a fella, and he was a nice guy, a really nice guy. And he ended up just, for some reason, he wanted to start booking people. And we were like, okay, sure. You know, if you want to book us somewhere, we'll be glad to see it goes. But then he put us in both places in one night. And it snowed that night too, you know, so then we had to lug everything up those Paragon steps, lug everything down those Paragon steps, load up in the snow and get to Baltimore. Okay. And we ended up going on late at the Paragon, and we're going up BW Parkway, and my van's fishtailing like crazy. I got sideways a couple of times, and then everybody was at the Rage. This was 90, and everybody was like, well, there were no cell phones. There was no way we could have called and let anybody know what was happening.
Right, right.
So I just pulled into that back alley. You remember that back alley with rats the size of German shepherds back there?
Saddle them up.
Oh, yeah. So we just pulled in. Door goes flying open. We just started running up on stage with our stuff. We got there just as the band before us had stopped and was pulling off the stage.
Nice. Well,
we
done.
Just got there, threw it up. Didn't even do a sound check, just threw it up, plugged in, and just started playing and let the sound man sort it out. and wow, what an adventure that night. What an adventure. You know, that was just, I thought we were going to end up in the median strip.
Well, you know, I mean, but those are the great stories. I mean, you know, you look back like right now with the gig that I'm doing. Well, again, COVID notwithstanding, I have a habit of doing that. But the gig that I'm doing right now, currently, you know, I've been with for 10 years and it's tour buses, it's airplanes, and more often than not, limousines are picking us up. Mm-hmm. So, I mean, it's a pretty cool gig. You still miss those days where, you know, the door of the van is broken. You're on a mountain in Pennsylvania. You're out of gas. You're not going to get to the gig. You're freezing cold, you know, but you got a little bit of schnapps left, and that's going to get you. I mean, those days you can't beat them.
I know. I mean, you're worried as hell that it's just not going to work, but you know, ends up it does working. You've got a great story at the end of it all, you know?
Yeah. And it was the biggest thing. It was the biggest disaster in the world. You know, if we don't get to this gig, it's all over, you know,
right.
It's like, hey, nobody died. Nobody lost a limb, you know? And the show went on, but man, the things we did to make the gigs happen back then. I remember I had 104 temperature, and we were playing at the Electric Circus. You remember the Electric Circus or in Ocean City? Oh. Electric Circus, and there was the back of the rack. We used to play both of those places, but it was the Electric Circus, and I had 104 temperature, and damn near killed me. I mean, and I got my drum tech pouring ice water on me after every song, literally dousing me in ice water. Did the show. And now I look back and it's like, what's one of the stupidest things you ever did? It's like, play it with 104 temperature.
Yeah. I know.
But we did the show and show went on and all good, you know, so kind of cool.
I know. Another thing I wanted to mention, if you remember, kind of like what the scene was like back in those days. Like you, I took a hiatus from playing too, but I wasn't around it at all. You went from being a performer to going and doing sound and production. So you were still around the scene. I went away for a while. You know, I played a lot between 87 and 94 were my full band years. And then I said, look, you know, I'm making no money and I've got to get something under my belt, some kind of career where I can start making some money, finish a degree. So I focused on that for a good while. And then I came back in 05. And there are a lot of things that I found that were different. I mean, one thing that I think you probably remember from playing in bands, unless you were at the level where you had a lot of professional promotion, if you had a show, you were out pounding the pavement with flyers. Do you remember that?
Oh, yeah. 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 Back in the day, that was everything. That and mailing lists.
Yes.
Remember you had your mailing list.
Mm-hmm. Yep.
And
snail
we spent.
Mail. Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And we spent as much on our mailing list as we made on a gigs, practically.
Oh,
you know,
yeah.
Our mailing list was enormous.
Yep.
And we ended up, you know, really doing well with that. And yeah, table tents and posters. And I mean, you name it, you name it. I mean, it was any form of promotion you could get. And, you know, you work in conjunction with the promoter who didn't really promote. They kind of booked it and then left it up to you a lot of times. You know,
yes,
it seemed like
yes.
That was the thing.
So what I wanted to ask was, you know, part of it was getting out and pounding the pavement and face-to-face with the people that would be coming to your show, shaking hands, buying a beer or something, giving out cassettes and flyers. So then I stopped and I went away and I came back in 05. So, and I play it in the, it's not a full band. It's an acoustic duo. Cause I decided that I had had it with five or six personalities. I want to deal with one other person. Right, so
understandable.
Yeah. So I went back and we booked a couple of shows and we had been doing open mics and we went out and booked a couple of shows and I went out to give out flyers. And it was like I walked up to people, I walked into the place we were playing and I was handing people flyers and they're like, what's this? I said, well, it's a flyer. And they said, well, what is this for? What is this? And I was like, well, my band is playing here and, you know, I'm giving out flyers to tell people. Well, why don't you just put it on MySpace? Well, you know, I like to meet people. And then, I mean, they looked at me like I was handing out like dead animals or something. I mean,
right.
Like they looked at me like I had, you know, like I had four heads. And I was like, you know, and I noticed a completely different, the neighborly feel was just gone.
Yes. There was that. And it did change. And it did come with that event where it was less person to person and more do it online, more distant. There was a, you call a cyber wall, if you will, in between you and the audience. All of a sudden, it was funny. I noticed a big change, and it's the same era because I moved to Phoenix in 92.
Okay.
And when I moved to Phoenix, my thought process at that time was, you know, I'm 33 years old and I've been there. I mean, I've had the career of a 50-year-old already, you know, with what we've done and the things I'd seen. And the Monarch was playing 250, 300 dates a year. I mean, we were relentless. It was mind blowing. And we did that for a decade, you know, so I moved out to Phoenix and it was the same thing. You didn't fly or anything, but I didn't know I was even going to be playing. So, but I did go to a couple of clubs and in DC and Baltimore, you know, it's like the girls get dressed up. They're looking good. They do their hair. They're in their makeup. They got their cool clothes on and their great, you know, shoes. The guys are looking good. They got their leather pants. They got their hair done up, you know. Phoenix, I'm walking into these clubs and people are wearing shorts, tank tops, sandals. And I'm going, what planet am I on here? I mean, this is like, and immediately I'm like, you ain't no DC. You ain't no Baltimore. You know, I was like very disappointed. And at the time, I hadn't really decided I was going to, you know, keep playing again. I didn't know what I was going to do, but I went to the clubs and I immediately went, wow, things are different, man. Not only with the geography from Phoenix to DC, but with the method that you were mentioning, just the method of getting the word out. And it just seemed like I had a hard time getting to know people initially here because of that. Mm-hmm. You know, I was able to take a job immediately at a music store teaching drums. So I was able to sustain myself right away, but I still wasn't sure where my career was going to go. But it was obvious things had changed with the internet, you know, style of music. So much changed in that time between 92 and 94. Radio formatting, all of it, you know, and so much. So it was hard to keep up at the time. It was a very confusing for the old guard, old cats like me who'd been there and just done the road and done it. We were like, wow, what do we do now? Because it's almost like I don't understand how it works. All that time you spend learning and figuring it out and going, okay, here's the process and here's what you got to do. You didn't have to do that anymore. You didn't have to play all the club circuits. You just had to have a good electronic press kit. Mm-hmm. And a half decent record, sit around in your underwear and send it out to 1,000 record labels a day, you know? And it was just like, it's a weird game. And I don't know, being from the old guard, old school, if you will, I wasn't sure I dug it, you know? And I still don't think I do. I'm still pining for the old days. If you
I know. Another thing that I wanted to mention too was in the Baltimore scene, especially. Yeah, we had an opportunity to play CBGBs in New York a couple of times. Mm-hmm. And whenever an opportunity came up like that, and it did, you know, with a number of bands, whenever they got a chance to go to, you know, New York, which was, you know, it was a major entertainment area where there were record labels and there were, you know, it was where all the executive offices for these places were. And that was where you would go to get signed. Mm-hmm. And a lot of times, and whenever a band had the opportunity to go up there, you know, the people around here would rally around that band, you know, the whatever gig they had before they would go up there. It was almost like, you remember Bon Voyage parties?
Sure.
When people would go on a vacation or something like that, you know, they would have a big thing. Hey, you know, Orange Sheet Parade's playing New York. And sometimes, you know, some of the bands that had, you know, a little more resources would put together a bus trip or a, you know, or some sort of a caravan or something like that to go up. Did you remember that stuff too?
Oh yeah. Yeah. Monarch. We did a showcase at Trax in New York.
Oh yeah,
we
used to play, sure.
Remember Trax up in what, 72nd and 9th or something like that? Upper West Side.
Yeah. That would have been,
right over by the Dakota, about two blocks from where Lennon used to live.
Yes. About halfway up
Central Park. Yep. Yeah, Central Park, yeah. West. Exactly. Mm-hmm. So we used to do tracks. We used to do the Cat Club. Mm-hmm. And we did a record showcase with our prison manager at the and so we arranged a big party bus trip from DC to there and back, mm-hmm. with accommodations and everything. And it was packed. I mean, it was a major event. Still, mm-hmm. to this, I think my liver is still a little mad at me.
Yeah.
So that, you know, we're on speaking terms, but you know, it's a lot of sarcasm. But yeah, so I mean, yeah, those were great. I mean, because people took a personal, it was like, mm-hmm. if somebody liked your band, it was their band, you know. Yes, it's like, yes. these are my guys, mm-hmm. you know, and they'd say, where are we playing? I mean, literally we would have people go, where are we playing? Where mm-hmm. are we gonna go next?
Right.
It's like,
right.
Oh, we're gonna be in Hammers or Network, or we're gonna be in Pennsylvania for a week, or we're gonna be on the road for a month and a half. We'll see at the rabbit's foot when we get back, you know.
Sure.
So, you know, it was that kind of thing. So it's great times. But yeah, people took a lot more personal interest. Nowadays, people it's because, you know, I think it is mm-hmm. because there was an investment. Mm-hmm. And I don't mean an investment monetarily, I mean an investment of your time. Mm-hmm. You put your clothes on, you went out to the club, you drove to the club, mm-hmm. and that investment is time and effort. Yep. And that's something more tangible, I think, a lot of times than just, you know, buying somebody's record, you know, sitting in your underwear online. When you're getting dressed, mm-hmm. you're doing your hair, you're getting all the Aquanet, getting it all just perfect, mm-hmm. and you're going to hit that club running, and you're going to bring your friends, and it's an event. Mm-hmm. Now it's like, you know, what are you doing? I don't know. I think I'm going to go down to some club and see some band. And it, in Phoenix, I don't know what the DC scene is like anymore, but Phoenix, it's a great analogy. What we were talking about before, like how DC and Baltimore are mm-hmm. separate, but close enough where you know, bands could play both. And, mm-hmm. and if your band was in Baltimore, you'd drive from DC to go see them, or from Baltimore to go see them at the Bayou or whatever. Mm-hmm. So out here, you know, there's like in Phoenix proper downtown, Alice Cooper used to have a club down there that we played a lot. And he became a really good friend and stuff, but that's gone. That thing's been gone for 5-6 years. And so in Phoenix, there's nothing downtown, hardly a couple of clubs, maybe, mm-hmm. but it's all East Side and West Side. And they're half hour apart mm-hmm. where the main hubs are, much like DC and Baltimore. Except there are no bands playing original music. They're all tribute bands or cover bands. I mean, if I hear Mustang Sally one more time in a club, I'm going to choke someone, right? I mean, so, or Rock and Roll by Led Zeppelin played really, really badly. And these are all sports bars, right? Where, you know, the band is playing and it's not even a stage. There's no lighting. You bring your own little mini PA. They got some soccer rerun above the band playing on a giant screen TV, and you're in the middle of a you know, singing a beautiful love song, and people are clapping because it was a goal scored. I mean, it's just
I know.
Right. You know, I mean, it's just like, that's where we're at now. That's where the club scene is at. I keep saying to my daughters, I'm so glad I'm old and got to live and participate and almost lead the parade during the heyday. Of such a magical moment in time, man. I mean, that DC Baltimore, that Eastern Seaboard from anywhere from Richmond on up through Dover.
Yes.
You know, and boy, it was just rife with so many great bands. I mean, the Cherry People, remember Cherry People? They turned into Sea Smash and Punky Meadows, you know, from Angel came from that. The Grimes Brothers, Sea Smash, you know, all these great bands, you know, Root Boy Slim and a Sex Change Band, Face Dancer, we've named them, Kick. So many great, great, great bands came from there. And there was a scene, and it wouldn't be like if something's happening at one club and it's packed that all the other clubs are going to be empty. Hell no. There was so much talent that you could go to any club on any Friday night. And there's a line at the door and people are paying $5 to get in.
Yes, they were. Yes, they were.
You know, it's so I, you know, back in the day, you know, sort of the going pay, you know, if your band was just kind of get going, you'd end up making about $100 a night each guy. Yep, right. Yep, yep. Monarch was making substantially more than that after a while, but essentially it's $100 a man. Mm-hmm. It's still to this day. You're going to get, if you play those sports bars around town, you're going to get about $100 a man still.
Yep. Yep.
Mm-hmm. And so you take the cost of living and the lack of rate increase, man, it's just like, come on, man. So it's almost like we've gone the way of the dodo bird, the whole live club thing.
In a lot of ways. Yes.
Yeah. So in a way it's almost sadly, not necessary, because if you want to discover new music, you don't have to go to a club. If you're a fan, you sit on the internet or listen to Spotify and they'll tell you, oh, if you like Crack the Sky, you'll love this band.
You know,
and you can do it in your pajamas and bunny slippers, for God's sake. So, you know, it's an odd time. Again, I'm kind of glad I'm old and went through the great times, because I wouldn't trade them for the world, man.
I mean, blame you. Yeah.
Right. I mean, we learned about music, but we learned about life, man. We learned how to make a budget. I remember I learned how to make an accelerator cable for a Chevrolet out of a Chuck Taylor tennis shoe at 4 in the morning. Our car broke down in Harlem one night, man. And it was like, give me a screwdriver. So I took a screwdriver and stabbed through the floorboard and took my shoelace off. I'm still wearing Chuck Taylors for that reason. If you ever need an accelerator cable to go to Chuck Taylor tennis shoe string. So I put the string down, ran the thing, tied it to the little thing on the carburetor. Mm-hmm. We were off in 15 minutes, man.
Awesome.
So, yeah. You know, you gotta make it happen. So I learned so much, you know, and lot of love, a lot of fist fights, a lot of gunfights, a lot of drinking and drugging, and a lot of good times, man. You know?
Yeah. One thing I wanted to mention too about New York, you had mentioned, you know, getting like a bus group together to go up to do it. We never had that kind of, those kind of resources, but we would get rider trucks. And we would get the kind that were, you know, the big box trucks, Ryder or U-Haul, but they would always have that like sliding little door hatch between the front cab and the back.
Yes. Yes.
And we would have, instead of a bus trip, we would have about 15 or 20 people back there sitting on couches and lazy boys that we would stick back there with our gear going to New York. Now, I think about that nowadays, and I'm absolutely horrified by that thought because going through the Lincoln Tunnel, we probably would have either been, nowadays, we probably would have either been picked up for human trafficking or suspicion of human trafficking, or God forbid, everybody would have died of carbon monoxide poisoning sitting back there.
That's so funny. That's hysterical. We had a trip to New England one time.
Okay, sure. Yeah.
And we had to, again, with our manager, our incarcerated manager, he, our first trip, we had to go to Maine to get a new vehicle. We've purchased a new van for the band. Get your gear up here. Bring all your guys. And we're like, well, how are we going to do it? Like, we'd have to rent a car. Well, we can't afford that. So we're like, God, shit. So, so we rent a U-Haul. We put all our gear in it because we're starting a tour up there. And there was about maybe 2 to 3 feet in any given space from the top of the gear to the roof of the truck. Mm-hmm. Three of us rode in the cab. It was 4 in the band and 5 in the road crew. Mm-hmm. We put camping lanterns in the back. We had that. We tied the back, the very back door open. So just enough where air could come in. And we rode in the back all the way to Maine, literally all the way to Maine. You know, we'd be riding sometimes and we'd be facing, you know, the in back of the truck with our back, you know, and with our legs hanging out. So it must have looked insane to anybody driving in back of the U-Haul truck.
Oh, yeah.
Because there's a couple, 2, 3 pair of legs sticking out. And, and the door was, you know, tied. So it was bouncing with every, you know, with every bump in the road. And we made it. And then we got our van. So it's all good. But yeah, crazy stuff like that, man. We did a gig in Pennsylvania once and I got a flat tire and jacked, you know, this old rickety jack, man. And there was snow on the side of the road and trucks, no shoulder, a hill. And every time a truck would go by, on it would just blow the van up on the jack. And we're like, man, this thing's going to roll over. Well, it did. It did. And so we had to get the van back up on it. I mean, I could, you know, I could go on and on. I mean, there's stories for every day of the week back then.
There sure were. There sure was. I mean, it was just really, you know, but, you know, something we lived. And these are the stories that you just don't have anymore.
Right. Amen to that. Stories
that you just don't have anymore. I mean, you know, and I would, you know, I had a van. It was a converted. It was a van that my family had that had seats in the back of it and everything. And we ended up taking out the 2 seats. And we would use that for our equipment and everything. And we would take it DC. We didn't go to New York in it, but it was older. And another thing too, I'm sure you probably did, if you, you know, had your own band truck, was, you know, the band members spent plenty of their own time under the hood.
Yes. Yes, we did.
Keeping that truck running. So you learned those skills as well, right?
Oh man. How to fix a truck, how to fix a you know, a monitor board, you know, how to repair a speaker jack on the fly, how to make a, you know, how to connect, you know, a battery using, you know, rolled up aluminum foil, you know, I mean, just any trick in the book, man, make it work, you know, get through the show, get to the gig, make it happen. Yeah, so you got clever, man.
You sure did. We were survivors, I think, too. You could
say. Yeah. Well, you know, you had to do it. I mean, it was, I mean, the most important thing in our life, even probably beyond try to stay alive for another day, was get to the gig. Make sure you do the gig and kill it, crush it, you know?
Oh, yeah.
And then you crush that gig and then you have a new goal. Crush the next one. And it was really it. And it was, you live for it. It was everything. It was everything. It was all that mattered. Mm-hmm. You know? So it was, yeah, it was great times, man. Well, you know, the thing too, you learned a work ethic. You really did, man. You know, when you had to get there and you had bare bones, you didn't have the tools to fix what was broken, but you fixed it anyway. Mm-hmm. You got to the gig and you made it work. It really taught me a lot of life lessons, man. I'm telling you.
Mm-hmm. It sure did. So I was looking at your resume some more. You've got, you know, so many folks. I mean, it's almost like a who's who of people that you've, you know, done sound production for. And I wanted to ask you about a couple of these here. You had mentioned Iggy Pop, the Ramones, and Rundgren, and Charlie Watts. And how was Motorhead?
Lemmy was awesome. He was the greatest. I loved him to death. He was so cool. Mm-hmm. He was, I think Lemmy enjoyed intimidating people.
Uh-huh.
But I'm not one who gets intimidated. I'll fire it right back at you with a grin on my face. Because I think, and I picked up on that right away. He was hardballing me immediately. Mm-hmm. And I volleyed right back immediately. And he kind of went, oh, all right, hey, all right. You're not going to take it from me, right? You know. So I remember he had set up he has two Marshall bass stacks, and he put them in a V in front of the drum riser at the Bayou. And he's got them cranked. I mean, I've never heard a bass sound coming out of off a stage that loud in my life. Mm-hmm. Ever. And I've seen The Who, and it was so loud. And of course he's screaming during the sound check, I can't hear me monitors. Mm-hmm. I can't hear me monitors. And I just shut down production. I go, dude, you're 126 dB on stage. Turn it down, you knucklehead, or something like that. And he started laughing, just belly laughing. And he goes, you're telling me to turn it down. And I'm like, well yeah. Mm-hmm. I didn't budge, and he got a big grin out of that. He thought that was the coolest thing, you know, just because I wasn't intimidated by his lemminess. You know?
Right.
It was kind of cool. It was a good moment, and we had a blast. It was a great show. They were amazing. Yeah, great memory. He was so cool. Took it like a champ.
No kidding. How about Leslie West? I saw him. I saw Mountain open for Triumph, I think around 85. And I loved him. I guess he was touring on his own, I guess, as a
solo. Yeah, that's a one that, you know, I love Mountain. I love Mountain. I love Leslie's solo stuff. Mm-hmm. One of the worst human being experiences I've ever had. I hate to say it. I know people who know him personally and say he's the nicest guy you'll ever know. Yeah. I think maybe he had a rough day or two. I don't know. Maybe he didn't have, because I know he was doing a lot of coke at the time. Mm. Maybe his stash was low. I don't know. But he came in swinging and hated everything. Wouldn't cooperate with everything. He was just, you know, I'm trying to get him up on time and he's trying to call the shots. I'm like, it's, you know, I basically said to him, it's not going to work this way. Mm. You know, I'm here every day. I've got the routine down. Work with me and I got you. And he just, he was not having it. Mm. And he added more amps. At one point I said, you know, Leslie, you're going to need to turn it down a little on stage. We've only got so much juice. It's a small stage. We can only get so much sound pressure before it feeds back. And that's what you're going to be dealing with. Mm-hmm. And so he actually then added 200 watt amps to his stack. And I'm like, all right, you're doing this on purpose. So it didn't go well. Wow. To say the least. So that was one that I was really disappointed in. I think probably my most disappointing show ever at the Bayou, because he was an idol of mine. Mm. So it was kind of one of those things, you know?
Yeah. Interesting.
It's a road thing though. I mean, we all have, you know, we got bad days, man, you know? So I kind of wrote it off like that. And it's like, dude, Leslie, you know, I shook his hand when we were done. I said, love you, man. I love you. Mm-hmm. You know, hopefully I'll see you again soon. And he wasn't having it.
Mm-hmm, sure.
Very disappointing.
Sure. Yeah. Yeah. I wanted to ask you too. So you had been, when we have drum clinics and things like that, you get folks coming to music stores or whatever to, you know, to do a clinic, I guess, to demonstrate and, you know, teach people things that they know. And it looks like you had been a tech for a, a good number of people here. And I see on the list that you gave me, you know, Doug Clifford from Creedence. I see Matt Sorum from Guns N' Roses. Did you have any favorites off of that list, or would you like to share some stories off of the folks you gave?
Yeah. Well, Doug from CCR is just a wonderful, just a great, great guy. Love him to death. He was so fun. And, you know, not only did we do the drum clinic together, but, you know, we actually had a lot of downtime where we could sit and chat. And he showed me, you know, a couple of those, you know, Creedence, a big part of Creedence's sound was the drums. He had a very unique style. You know, you could, the harmonies, the vocals, the guitar, that was one thing. And that was one element of Creedence. But to get that authentic, you know, Creole rock, Cajun, sort of shuffly sound, man. Doug Clifford was the man. And it's almost like a Levon Helm, where it's a very unique style. And you listen to it, or a Bunny Carlos, where it's not hard to play, but it sure is hard to make it feel like he made it feel. And so Doug was great that way. But I think my favorite, well, there was two really good stories. One was Matt Sorum from GNR. I don't know. Are we R-rated here? Was this a family event here?
It doesn't matter. If you want to tell something, I can always, I usually put like a warning on there about language or something. So it's not a big
deal. I'll keep it clean. When we're done with the clinic, it was him and the Sabian rep and another rep from maybe his drum head rep or somebody, I forget. Mm-hmm. But he's like, all right, let's go to a strip bar. This is out here in Phoenix. So I know a couple of girls and stuff. So I called ahead and said, hey, set us up a VIP area. I got some people coming. Mm-hmm. So we went into this really fancy strip bar. And of course, we're upstairs in the VIP lounge. And Matt was like, make it rain, you know, entertain my friends and drinks for everybody. One of those, absolute debauchery, as you can imagine it. So when that got out of hand, we ended up getting thrown out of there, because it was just getting out of control. And so there was another place open. So he goes, well, let's go there. So we'd had a few by then. Matt was pretty hammered. I don't know if I should say this, but yeah, I'm going to say it. Hell with it. Happened. So we go to this place, and I guess somebody had called ahead and said, hey, the dude from Guns N' Roses is coming down there. So we walked in the front door of this second strip club, and that song from Use Your Illusion, You Could Be Mine, came as soon as we walked in the door, that came over the sound system. Well, one girl's up there dancing, and, you know, we're kind of holding court there for about a minute and a half. And Matt can't stand it anymore. He decides he's going to jump up on stage and he's going to dance now for us. So his pants were down, and you don't do that. You just can't do that. This is the law. So, all hell broke loose. The lights went on, the sound went off. It was just like, you know, like one of those scenes out of a Mel Brooks movie where somebody shoots a gun in the air and people scatter. There was no gun, but it was the scattering, you know, and it was, the cops were on their way. It was just mayhem. So we all get in our cars and, you know, people are heading in all directions. And, you know, I called Matt the next day. I was like, where did you end up? He goes, I'm laying low, man. He goes, I'm not going to the airport. So he ended up staying in town an extra day. I guess he was hiding from the cops or something. I don't know the full detail. The Sabian rep after that was never my friend after that. He didn't like me much, but that didn't really care about that. But so that was a great encounter. That was just one of those, oh my God. And of course, it's the Guns N' Roses guy. So it couldn't have been cooler. I did a clinic with Liberty DeVito one time with, it was Billy Joel's drummer forever. And I told him, you know, hey, tell me a cool story so I can tell my students. And he was talking about that song, Don't Go Changing, right? And I guess it was the last song on that album that they were recording. They were done with the record, except for this song. We get through this song, we all go home, right? And prepare for the tour. So Liberty is having a hard time with this beat, you know, not that it was a difficult beat. It was everything he played was, it's too pedestrian. You know, the producer and Billy, it's too fancy. It's too busy. It's too plain. It's not enough this. It's too much that. And he's getting nuts. He's getting frustrated. So he goes home the next day and he's like, man, I'm about to get fired from, you know, and they spent all day and Billy's getting pissed off about it. So he's like, oh, man, you know, so he comes back. He, I guess he was living on a stay in Long Island. They're recording at the record plant. He's driving in town, goes through over the bridge or through the tunnel. And that song by Roberta Flack comes on, Killing Me Softly.
Right? Oh, sure. Right. Right.
Right. So he's kind of just tapping it out. And it's not a drum heavy song by any means. So he's kind of tapping it out on the steering wheel, and he gets to the studio. And he's going, well, here I go. I'm about to get fired. So he sits down at his drums and he's like, Billy's not there. The engineer's there. So the engineer fires up the system and Liberty is just kind of tapping out the Killing Me Softly rhythm on his drums, waiting to be fired, basically. And Billy walks in and goes, that's it. That's the beat. And Liberty's like, wait, what? And he's like, yeah. He goes, how? And Billy goes, the greatest answer of all time is that Billy goes, so how did you come up with that? He goes, Liberty goes, it just came to me on the way in today. You know, hand delivered. And I just thought that was the greatest story of all time. You know, so I just was like, that you can't top that. And he saved his gig, obviously. And of course, I think the song, I don't know if it went to number one, but it was a top 10 hit. So
it did. Yeah, it did get up. That was a big hit for him. That sure was.
Yeah. So that was a really cool moment. So, and then a lot of good close up moments when you're doing tech work for guys like that. You know, there's always a good story to be told, you know, Steve Gadd and stuff like those cats, you know.
Mm-hmm. You had, it also said on here that you had worked with Gilby Clark from Guns N' Roses too.
Yes. I've got a few little Guns N' Roses things in my past. I played in a band called the Beat Angels out here. They are a glam pop, sort of a throwback to the Sweet or Nick Gilder, if you will, kind of a power pop band out of Phoenix. Actually, quite a cult band. Look them up, Beat Angels. Mm-hmm. And they had done two records. Their drummer had passed away. I was a huge fan of them. I'd seen them a few times around town. They toured a lot. Alice Cooper was one of their big sort of supporters. Mm-hmm. And their drummer passed away. And I was shocked. He's a great friend and an amazing drummer. And they had they walked up to me at a club one time and they asked me, would I play with, you know, would I be interested in playing with the Beat Angels? And I'm like, yeah, I mean, absolutely. So I hooked up with them, and Gilby had produced their first two records and was slated to produce their third record, which I ended up doing their third album. And Gilby was the producer. So that's how I met Gilby for the first time doing that record. And then Gilby had a touring band when he was doing his pawn shop guitars era, you know, and that stuff. So right around that, a couple albums in, he was touring with Teddy Zigzag from Guns N' Roses, Muddy Stardust, who was supposedly Mark Bolan's illegitimate son. I don't know. He looks like him a lot. So I mean, like, dang. And a couple other cats. So he asked me if I'd be interested in playing with him some shows. I'm like, oh, absolutely. So I learned Gilby's material and did some shows with him. He still owes me $200. Gilby, you still owe me $200, by the way, bud.
That's great. So, geez, wow, you've got so many. You worked with John Popper from Blues Traveler, it says here too, huh?
Well, that was more of a jam. Now, some of those are now that with John Popper, his management and the band I'm currently with is Louis Prima Jr. and the Witnesses. Now, you may know who Louis Prima is, the jazz trumpeter, famous for Jump, Jive, and Wail, the original Jump, Jive, and Wail, Just the Gigolo. He wrote Sing, Sing, Sing. He wrote Sunday Kind of Love, the Reba McEntire. And he was King Louie in the Jungle Book. I'm the king of the swingers, the jungle VIP, right?
Oh, yeah,
You, talk like you. So I play with his son, Louie Jr. Well, our management company also manages Blues Traveler. So they booked us on a big, big festival out west called Bottle Rock. And it was like Jane's Addiction, Black Crowes, Joan Jett. God, I mean, you name it. Avett Brothers. I'm running out. I can't even remember. Just so many damn bands. It's, you know, top name bands. Mm-hmm. And we were on the bill. So what they did was they rented a local movie theater. All the musicians, the promoter did it for the musicians. So after the concert, it was a 4-day concert event. Afterwards, the bands could come to this movie theater and music gear was set up. So we just jammed all night. And so everybody was there. You know, Perry Farrell from Jane's Addiction He came up and sang a tune, Popper, and I sang an AC/DC song up front, and Popper's playing harmonica to it. You know, I mean, it was, so that was one of those nice events. But yeah, I got to know John through our management stuff. So yeah, I ended up doing actually that with them. That was kind of fun. He's a great, that guy. You talk about funny human being and some stories. That guy got some stories. My God. Yeah.
I bet he does.
Super, super cool guy.
Yep. Had you worked with Chuck Berry too?
Yes, I did work with Chuck Berry. I played a show with him. Actually, it was Monarch did that. We were on the road. We were in Florida. And we were scheduled to play two nights at a place called The Joint in the Woods in Orlando, Florida, just outside of Orlando. It was a Friday, Saturday, and we'd sold out both nights. It was about 1,200 seat club. So we're doing great. You know, they love us down there. So after the first night, club owners, before we left to go back to the hotel, said, "Hey, check this out." And he handed us a Chuck Berry best of CD, greatest hits CD, or cassette.
At the time,
It was 79. What am I talking about? He goes, "Familiarize yourself with this. Chuck's going to be playing with you guys tomorrow night." So essentially, when we got back the next night, Monarch played our first set. And then we were Chuck Berry's band for the evening. That was, I did a podcast. You can look it up on, it's still online. I stopped doing it last year when the COVID hit. But it's called the Shabby Road Record Show, like Abbey Road, but shitty.
Yeah, you were telling me about that. Yeah.
And we do, you know, it's a cool little show, but we have these subgenres of our own show. And one is called Lifers. And the Lifers sub series that we do is all about being a lifer in the music business. And so we tackle different subjects, like what's it like being a father and traveling? You know, what's it, you know, so that was one of our episodes. And one of the episodes was, what was not your best gig, but what was your favorite gig that you ever did? And at the top of that list is Chuck Berry. Obviously, it's Chuck Berry, right? But we did another episode. What was your least favorite gig you ever did? And at the top of that list was Chuck Berry. So as it goes, and Chuck's legendary for this. We finish our set. He comes back in the dressing room. We're all sitting down and he's pacing back and forth like a drill sergeant. "I'm Chuck Berry. These are my songs. You better know them. You better not screw them up. If you do, there's going to be hell to pay. If I screw up, I'm blaming one of you because they're my songs." And I'm like, "Oh, great. This is going to suck." So we get out there and we're killing it. I'm looking over on my right and my brother Jeff is just, we're looking at each other like, "Dude, Chuck Berry, Chuck effing Berry." And we're grinning and we are killing it. I thought we were killing it, right? Bass player's up there. We're just locking it in. Chuck's doing his duck. Crowd's going nuts. We're in the middle of singing Nadine. "Nadine, honey, is that you?" Right? Chuck turns and he looks at me and he starts yelling something. He's about 10 feet in front of me. I'm back of the drum kit. So I don't hear him. He's off the mic and yelling something. And I'm like, so I keep playing. And now he's pissed. He's yelling and he's daggers coming out of his eyes. And he stops and he's screaming at me, "What were we singing? What were we singing?" And I'm like, "Nadine, Chuck, Nadine." So he starts the band back up and he starts kicking into Roll Over Beethoven, which we had already played. So I'm like, "Nadine, Chuck, Nadine." And he's looking at me. He's stops again and he walks up to that mic and he ripped me to shreds.
Oh,
just,
man.
This goddamn drummer, this F and F, this and these freaking all this. And I'm just like, "Fuck you, Chuck Berry." That was my, you know, and I'm a 19-year-old kid, you know, and I'm playing and we were killing it. We were doing his songs a lot of justice, you know. And I literally, it was the only time I can ever remember breaking down in tears on a stage. I was crushed. I mean, I can't even tell you that. That's Chuck Berry. I went from the highest high the most, I mean, Chuck freaking, I'm playing with Chuck Berry.
Yeah.
To Chuck Berry thinks I suck.
Well, obviously you proved him wrong, you know, with,
Well, as the Turtles, as Mark Volman and Howard Kale and Flo and Eddie once eloquently said, throwing holes in your rock and roll balloons.
Yes, exactly.
My balloon popped so hard that night. It was the longest, most miserable night. I still think about that, and I don't get emotional, but it still gets in my gut a little bit.
Yeah,
you know,
sure.
I'm not complete over. I don't think I'll ever be over that. That mm-hmm. he took that one from me. Chuck took that one from me.
Well,
you know, we served him well, man. That guy.
You had mentioned that you had your the Shabby Road Records show, and yes. I see you've got quite a bit of material to work with behind you there.
Yes.
My God, is that the Library of Congress or is that your vinyl collection?
There's everything in there from Nina Simone to Frank Sinatra to the Sex Pistols, everything in between. I've got a Charles Manson record back there. I mean, it's insane. So this is my recording studio, Shabby Road Studio, of course. Mm-hmm. And when I set up the studio for recording, I wanted good, not sound diffusers, but good sound baffles. Like it's good to have something in back of the drum kit that isn't too reflective sonically. Mm-hmm. And somebody I'd seen some studios that had bookshelves and just loaded with books. And they are mm-hmm. a great, great sound baffler. Mm-hmm. And I thought, well, if books work, then records would work. So I don't know if you can see the kind of the drum area of the studio mm-hmm. back here. And so I brought my records down and set them up, and man, the drums have never sounded better.
Awesome.
So
awesome.
Yeah, I'm down at my studio 90% of the time anyway. So I brought everything down here.
That's great. You know, I just built something in my garage and I used for recording voiceover auditions. And I just used moving blankets.
Those are really good.
And it worked well. I mean, I could hear a big difference in what I've been recording. And I'm about to start podcasting out there once it gets a little bit warmer. It was only 30 degrees here today at night. So I'm not going out there like that. But
no, I won't tell you that it was 70 in Phoenix today.
Oh, hey, I love it, man. I'd come visit there if I could, you know.
Bring it on, brother. Bring it on. Plenty of room for you.
That would be great. That would be great. You know, so in wrapping it up here, I've had a blast talking to you, you know, and,
likewise, thank you.
I've just had such, I've just enjoyed, you know, hearing about, you know, like our similar experiences and just, you know, kind of talking, you know, being able to identify with, you know, the way things were like years ago and being able to share this history with us. I really just appreciate you being willing to take the time to be with us and share today.
Well, I really appreciate you doing this. I mean, if you weren't doing this, who would be? So I thank you for shining a spotlight on an incredible era in a great place. I mean, if you talk about that sort of that time space continuum, we hit it.
We
and
did.
It was good. You know,
so
thank you for shining a light on that, man. We appreciate
those were great times. Those were great times back then, and there were just so many great memories. And I've got more coming too. I've got more coming too, folks. You know, so stick around. And what I like to do is I like to kind of put this section of the show out there for you to shamelessly plug as shamelessly as you would like. Anything you would like to shamelessly plug and be as shameless as you want to be.
This is the Gene Simmons portion of the program, is it not?
I would say yes.
Excellent. Yes, yeah. Well, I'm fortunate enough right now when the pandemic hit to have gotten a phone call from a legendary producer, a guy named Otto Donaiolo, who's got platinum records with Kenny Rogers. He's a guy out here. He's based out of Phoenix. He's worked with Stevie Nicks, Alice Cooper, Lyle Lovett. You name it. Nils Lofgren. He's worked with Nils. Nils lives out here now.
Oh, okay.
DC guy. So Otto called me.
I'd like to talk to him, by the way.
I'll get a hold of him for you.
Okay.
Yeah, I'll get a hold of him. But Otto called me one day and says, hey, I'm doing a television show on Amazon Prime. would you like to be on it? I'd like to have you as a mentor. It's called The Recording Artist. It's not only a website. So you can go to the www.therecordingartist.com and it's basically him recording bands. But the television show is a reality show of basically him recording bands. How many people who are not in bands have actually been in a recording studio and seen the process? So you're literally on screen. You can even type in, hey, bass player, I don't like that bass part. I don't like, or you need to add more treble to your tone. I mean, so it's interactive as bands are recording their next single. And it's amazing.
Oh,
it's
wow.
called The Recording Artist. Yeah. So it's a really cool concept. Never been done. We got 3 episodes out right now. It's The Recording Artist on Amazon Prime Network TV. I'm also playing with Louis Prima Jr., Louis, L-O-U-I-S Prima Jr. and The Witnesses. That's my current project. We just did our 3rd album. We sat on it though for the COVID. It's going to be out. It was supposed to be out in June, but we're holding on to it. We recorded that one at Capitol Records, which is a dream come true. So that's happening right now. That's one of my main events. I've also played with, just did an album with Roscoe, Joan Jett's guitar player. He was producing an album that I did with a band called DL Marble. Mm-hmm. And so that's kind of an Americana, like if Johnny Cash had heavier guitars, it's what it would, and he would probably stab you. I'm a little afraid of DL. I'm just, which I kind of like that. I'm a little afraid of him. Mm-hmm. But DL Marble, I just did their 3rd album. So that's cool. You can still check out old episodes of the Shabby Road Record Show, www.shabbyroadrecordshow.com. It's a lot of fun. We just spin records from my collection. My co-host brings records. I bring records. I don't know what he brought. He doesn't know what I brought. And we take turns telling stories about the record, an experience we've had with the song. Maybe I got in a fist fight with the bass player one day. We'll talk about it. Anything goes. And then we have a lot of our celebrity friends on as guests as well. They bring records on. So it's a hoot and a half, and we're just having cocktails, having a blast. And it's as fun as it gets. So that's, you might want to check that one out too. So,
well, definitely. It sounds great. Well, AD, again, we really appreciate everything you brought to the table for us tonight here as far as stories and everything else. And thank you for being part of our program tonight, folks. Again, this is AD Adams, and thank you all for listening, and we'll see you next time. AD, thanks, buddy.
Mike, cheers. Thank you, buddy. Cheers.
Howdy. It's Matt Gwynn here, popping in to let you know about the Adventures of the Albino Rhino. It's a show Frank the Giraffe here, my co-host, James Godwin, and myself put on for you guys twice a week. Every Wednesday, we talk to a comedian, and every Friday, we call it Freak Yeah Friday. The show itself is not safe for work, and that freak is definitely a different word. I just don't know what podcast you're going to be listening to this promo on, and I don't want to, start screaming explicatives while you're sitting in your office, if you're lucky enough to have been able to go back to the work that you did before inside of an office or whatever, But we go on an adventure twice a week, and it's a good time because we get to sit down and talk to some really cool people. And I enjoy it because, I'm just curious little albino who likes to get to know folks, You can find us a couple ways, actually multiple ways, really. Man, there's a lot of different ways to find us. You can find us through our central hub, which is www.albinorhino.me. It's the website. Find me on. And then, the podcast, you can find the videos on YouTube. Search for Adventures of the Albino Rhino. Also linkable from our website. And you can also find us through Anchor, Breaker, Google Podcasts, Apple Podcasts, Overcast, Radio Public, and Spotify. That's right. We're on the same place Joe Rogan is. Granted, we're not the Joe Rogan Experience, but you know what I mean? We're there. So give us a listen. Promise you won't be dissatisfied. And enjoy your day.
is going on, minions? Mike here for Misery Point Radio, and you're listening to the Coast to Coast Power Hour on the SJ Network. Now, I know what you're thinking. Mike, what the F is a Coast to Coast Power Hour? Well, my uneducated and uninformed friend, the Coast to Coast Power Hour is a Borg-like collective of epic podcasters from epic podcasts that have all come together to discuss the important things in life. Pop culture, current events, random awesomeness, stuff like that. Trust me, you need this in your life. For more information on this show and all the shows on the Coast to Coast Power Hour, as well as on the SJ Network, reach out to publicist Steve Joyner at www.s-j-network.com or stevesjnetwork@gmail.com. No need to thank me. I'm just out here, you know, changing lives.
What's Your Effin' Binge is a podcast brought to you by Chris, Anchor, and Spotify. And what we talk to our guest about is what they're currently binge-watching on TV. And what we do is we like to take a different approach. I don't want to know what the name of the show is that they're going to talk about before they come on. I have to actually guess it. So I ask them who, what, when, where, why, and try to figure out what it is that they're watching. A lot of times I'm able to guess it, and sometimes I'm not. And that's fine. That adds to the comedy of the show. We like to bring our guest on, whether they're a model or an actress or a producer or musician, and just let them have a platform to be able to tell everybody what they have coming up next, and also entertain everybody with what's worth watching. So I hope everybody tunes in for the next episode of What's Your Effin' Binge. Thanks. It's Chris.